The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
If you are looking for life and career enhancements, you need experts that have been there, done that, tried, sometimes failed, and ultimately succeeded. Welcome to The Business of Living with Scott Ventrella. You may be looking for help with relationships, health and wellness, home life, career, finance, or faith. We hopefully have the answers you are seeking. Now, here is your host, Scott Ventrella.
Welcome to the show, and we're going to be talking about, let me just put it this way, and I want you to be honest with me, okay? Are you addicted to technology? Yeah, you heard me. Are you addicted to technology? Yeah, it's becoming increasingly common. I've heard a lot of terms being thrown around, but there's one in particular. This is a Dr. Gary Small, who's out of UCLA. And I'm actually reading from one of his blogs where he says that, you know, we often think of addiction as something like alcoholism, drug use, you know, substance abuse. But actually, there is, he's got a name for this. You know, we can become addicted to all forms of technology, you know, the internet, email, texting. I'm sure that you're probably, you know, messing around with your technology right now as you hear my words, chatting, twittering, et cetera. It's all kinds of, you know, it's a form of compulsive and dependent behavior. So the term is techno addicts. Now, is that you? I don't know. If I'm honest with myself, I would say I try to put some boundaries around that stuff. I know that there are some people actually that are seeking professional help for their techno addiction. Here's some five surefire signs that, you know, you may have a problem. You know, the feeling that when you're not able to locate your smartphone is the same as when you lose your wallet or your purse. You know, your heart rate starts to race. You start getting, you know, hot under the collar and start to get panicky, anxious, or when your battery's running down. You know, I've seen people at the airport. I was traveling last night, and somebody said, "Oh my gosh, I need an outlet. I need to plug in." Or you're with somebody. So I was talking to somebody last night on my way back from the airport, and yeah, he was saying, "Yeah, you know, I've got a real problem because I'm constantly checking my my phone, my text, my email." And sometimes, you know, obviously that can get in the way of good communication, relationships. It can be really off-putting. I remember one time I was at a restaurant in New York City, and I was actually there by myself. I was traveling there on business, and there was a couple, and I would say pretty much through the whole night. Obviously, when you're eating alone in a nice restaurant, what else is there to do unless you're checking your phone? You watch people. So I watched pretty much, occasionally I'd kind of look over. And this nice young couple were there, and all through the course of dinner, the guy's there on his phone. He was talking on his phone. He was texting. I could just tell by the expression on her face that she wasn't too happy. If this was a Match.com date, I think that might have been the last one. Okay, a couple more. So you check your email just before going to bed. Worse yet, you leave it on your your smartphone on your nightstand, or you sneak. You know, you're one of those, you know, you do it covertly. You know, you're at a party or out with a family gathering and you make an excuse to, "I left something out in my car," so that you could actually, you know, check in, especially if there's been a significant amount of heat on you. Even if it's a few of the five or six that I just mentioned, you may have an addiction. Now, is this a good thing? Well, of course, you know, no addiction is really good. You know, why do we do it? You know, there's actually, and I'm not going to get into this right now because I'm anxious to get to our guest, but there are actually, you know, it does kind of tie a little bit into how our brain works, the brain chemistry, dopamine, but, you know, we'll keep it a little bit on the light side. But akin to this subject is, And I'm making this correlation here, and I'll ask our guest in just a minute about this. But I think akin to that is the what our guest refers to as the distraction addiction. So I'm pleased to welcome to the show Kim Soo-jung. I'm sorry. This has been a long morning. Let me do this again, and I apologize, Alex. It's Alex Soo-jung Kim Pong. Now, what
exactly?
He does,
well,
Alex,
done.
Is this the first time this has happened?
No. Oh, absolutely not. No, yeah. Not to worry.
So listen. Well, here's the important thing. Well, the names are important. So Alex studies people, technology, and the worlds that they make. He's got a book out that just came out in 2013 called The Distraction Addiction. He talks about the contemplative computing, and we're going to ask about that. There's a mouthful. Alex is a consultant at Strategic Business Insights. It's a think tank in Silicon Valley. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you heard a little bit in my introduction, and I know that having gone through some of your material, that it may not be the same thing. You know, I'm talking about the, you know, surefire ways that, you know, you may have some kind of an addiction technology. But as I went through your material, it looks like there is some kind of a connection to the two. Let's just start with this term. What is contemplative computing? And what is the, well, let me back up. What is the distraction addiction? What does that mean?
Well, Sian, it's really the things that you were talking about in the introduction, and the fact that we now live in a world in which we are surrounded by and carry around weapons of mass distraction. You know, technologies that not only...
Oh, boy, there we go. Hold on. Yeah. Wait, I want to hear that again. Weapons of mass distraction. There's a new one, folks.
Of mass
you heard
distraction.
It here first. All right.
But, you know, the characteristics of this world are that, you know, these are technologies that offer, in some cases, just in... you know, things like intermittent results or intermittent rewards. Email is a really good example. You know, you open it up, sometimes you have new mail, sometimes you don't, but you get a little charge whenever you get a new message. Sometimes it's a good charge, sometimes it's not.
It depends, you know, on what's in the subject line and who it's from.
Right. But, you know, the fact is that, you know, as many a gambler will tell you, the only thing more pleasant than winning is losing, that, you know, just getting, you know, just having that reaction is itself something that your body comes to like. And so, or if this is at the root of, or of the phenomena that you see, of, or sometimes we've done ourselves, of, you know, people checking email when they are, you know, stopped at a stoplight or in line at the bank. But we also now have a whole host of technologies and services that consciously play upon those kinds of reactions that don't just happen to turn out to be addictive, but are designed to be. Behavioral scientists have learned an awful lot in the last 20 or so years, thanks to work they've done in the laboratory, thanks to watching people playing video games, thanks to addiction science, about what, you know, about how to hook people to products. And so, you know, if you look at the design of games on Facebook or Angry Birds or Candy Crush, you can see them using those techniques in order to get people playing and to get them hooked in the fairly clinical sense. So the idea behind contemplative computing is that we can learn how to resist those kinds of those designs, those impulses, and we can learn how to use these devices not to self-distract, not to sort of make ourselves more mentally or fractured, but to learn how to be more focused and more mindful and effectively become better people. And so the argument of the book really is that, you know, yes, technologies try to do these things to us, but even in a world that is trying very hard to sort of eliminate the sense that we have a choice about how we use these, that we have a choice about how they're going to affect us, we can still redesign these to serve our purposes rather than to have them serve the purposes of Facebook or King Media or Twitter.
So I want to go back to a point you made because you really got my attention with this. Okay, I used to be a closet angry bird. You know, I was addicted to that thing, and my kids would make fun of me. Here I'm a 54-year-old man, and I'd be on an airplane or the train, and of course it was like the old days. You know, when you were in school and you put your comic book in, you know, inside the history book, so no one would notice what you were doing. So what is it exactly that kind of, because it reminds me, and I'm not a gambler, but it reminds me of the gambler. I've been to casinos, but more as an observer with groups. And, you know, you're watching people at the blackjack table or people playing craps or, you know, whatever the game might be. There is this kind of an adrenaline rush, and whether it's, oh my gosh, I was so close, I got to try again. It's almost like the one-armed bandit and, oh, I came so close to hitting the jackpot, and you keep, you know, throwing in the quarters. Or you do win, and that even, it seems like that fuels it even more. So what is it specifically, and I'm just using Angry Birds as an example, like you said, they do it with, what is it, Candy Crush? I don't have
Candy
that.
Crush.
I had to get away from all that stuff because it was, you know, I've got a job to do, Alex. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So what are the techniques that they're using?
Okay. So one of them is the technique that's called intermittent rewards. So, you know, sometimes it's not always the case that doing the same thing yields a reward. Interestingly, that's kind of dull. It becomes more compelling if you lose sometimes. So now, with the case of Angry Birds, I think part of it is that the gameplay is very fast. You know, sort of when you lose a game, you can restart it very quickly, and so it's easier to have a second thing happen, which is to get into what game designers and psychologists call a flow state. You know, that state where sort of you're very mentally absorbed in the game. You're not sort of you don't have to pay attention to anything else, and you also get caught up in the sense that, you know, this time you really can beat it. And so I think Angry Birds does a really good job of playing into that. Now, it's also the case that game designers spend a lot of time figuring out how much harder to make the next level to keep you engaged. Right? They don't want to make the next level so hard that you get frustrated and give up. They want to make it hard enough so that you get frustrated and hit replay. Now, for games like Candy Crush, there is a social dimension to them as well. So, you know, you hit a roadblock, you have trouble with a level, and you can you can appeal to friends. Or gift you something so that you can sort of get a secret, or some special sort of weapon or something or a hint, or you can buy them. And at its height, the Candy Crush people were making something like $1 million a day on in-app purchases on a free game, which is, you know, when you think about the basic fact that, you know, this is a free game that you can download. The fact that some people could spend hundreds of dollars a month playing this thing was absolutely remarkable. And of course, a lot of other game companies have taken notice of this and tried to and copied that strategy. I think another great thing, and by great I mean sort of very powerful thing that some games do, is socialize gameplay in another way. So there's a game called Drawsome, which is, or if you draw a picture and your friends have to guess what it is. If you both win, you get some points, and then or if the game starts again. Now, and the way that this is set up is that when a round finishes, a new round begins instantaneously. So there's really no break. So it promotes that kind of flow state. But there also is not a natural stopping point, right? You know, when you're playing a game, you know, when you're playing a board game with your friends, the game ends when someone wins. Draw sum, on the other hand, never ends in that sense. And so when you quit, and I deleted the game, when I realized that this was going on, when you leave the game, you have this sense of abandoning your friends. It's like right. getting up from the table in the middle of a conversation and go, and, you know, we don't like to do that. We are social animals, and that is, you know, that goes against of our socialization and our nature.
So Alex, that reminds me of, again, as a kid, with when we had, you know, just the old-fashioned telephones, and you're talking to somebody, and you say, okay, goodbye, and they say, goodbye, I'm hanging up now, okay, goodbye, and, you know, keep going. It's, so I see that a lot with the texting. So somebody sends you a message, you respond, and then they feel compelled to respond, and it goes back and forth, back and forth. I find this with so many people. It's incredible. So here's the question. You know, so again, in the opening of the show, I talked about, well, you know, other kind, you know, we usually think of addiction as maybe, you know, alcohol or drug, or even, you know, some people have an addiction to, something as simple as, you know, chocolate. So those things, you know, we make the connection. Yeah, that's bad. You know, if I'm addicted to whatever it might be, that long term can affect my health. But with technology, I don't think people necessarily make the connection. So my question is it necessarily a bad thing to be addicted to some of this stuff?
The answer is, unfortunately, it depends. So not to weasel out of it. But I think, first off, that one of the important things to sort of remember about addiction is that it is in the most literal physiological sense, all in your brain, right? So we become addicted to things when our brains learn to react to them in particular ways. They get certain kinds of rewards, particularly lots of dopamine, and we discover that continuing to engage in this behavior or consume this thing gives us more of sort of that reward. Now, one of the pernicious things about some kinds of addictions or addictive things is that the power of that reward decreases over time. And so the thousandth hit of a drug is not nearly as powerful as the first one, but we still have a really good memory of that first one. And so we continue to seek out of that first high. Is it the case that we can talk about technologies as being addictive? You know, this is something that scientists are continuing to argue about, and it gets into all kinds of details about exactly how you define addictive behavior. But is it entirely a bad thing? The answer is that the problem is that, you know, really no, because here's the challenge. Humans are really, really good at learning how to use technologies in ways that make the technology almost like an extension of ourselves. This is something that humans may be uniquely capable of that separates us from the whole rest of the animal kingdom. When you are, let's say, driving a car or riding a bicycle, and, you know, you have that sense of being in perfect control. You're able to do things with this machine, you and this machine together, that you can't do on your own. That's a really powerful and really good thing. It is what has allowed us to, you know, invent and play musical instruments. It's something that use of technologies to expand our cognitive abilities, to expand our physical abilities, is something that, if you interview jet pilots, if you interview Ernest Hemingway after spending hours at his typewriter, jazz musicians, they all talk about that kind of special relationship that they have with their tools. And the kind of addictive relationship that we sometimes develop with games or email or what have you is the dark side of this good thing.
Okay, so we're gonna need to take a break. I want to get back into that. So on that note, yeah, the dark side of what could, you know, this good thing, right? When we come back after the break, we'll dig a little bit more into that. We're speaking with Alex Soo-Jung Kim Pong. You're listening to The Business of Living. We will be right back right after these messages.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com. If you are interested in real estate in America's largest city or anywhere, be sure to listen for Good Morning New York Real Estate with Vince Rocco. Although our focus is on Manhattan and other real estate markets in and around New York City, we'll have plenty of information that will help you successfully buy, sell, and close a transaction no matter where you are in the world. Good Morning New York Real Estate with Vince Rocco can be heard every Tuesday at 9 a.m. in New York, 6 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
The world we live in has become a crazy place. Poverty is at an all-time high in the wealthiest nation on earth. We keep calling on government to save us with new programs. And now, we have more people using food stamps than any time in our history. This problem continues to get worse. The answer to poverty is in our homes, churches, and communities, and through our children. Get the answers from The Mickey Ellison Show, Wednesdays at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern, on Voice America Variety.
We all love our best friend, especially when that best friend is a canine best friend. Now there's a show just for the dogs, or the people who love them. Tune in to Dogs Rock Radio with host Pamela Hill. With your stories and advice from the experts, we'll show just how much love and purpose dogs bring to our lives and others around us. You'll also learn about canine fitness, training, and health and wellness. Make Dogs Rock Radio a weekly stop every Monday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on Voice America Variety.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
This is The Business of Living with Scott Ventrella. To reach the show today, call in to 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to scott@thebusinessofliving.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. We are talking about techno addiction. That is not a term that I've come up with, but I just actually came across that in researching for this show. We're speaking with Alex Soo-Jung Kim Pong. Alex is a there we go. It took me 50 times, but I finally got it. During the break, I was rehearsing that. So anyway, with Alex, Alex is a consultant at Strategic Business Insights. It's a think tank in Silicon Valley. His most current book is The Distraction Addiction. And just before the break, Alex, you know, we were talking about, and I had mentioned that, you know, okay, I think people can understand when some kind of a substance, there's a substance abuse addiction, or even a gambling addiction, you know, you're running through money, and you got to be at that horse track or that casino. But with technology, I don't think a lot of people realize or think about, you know, is this really doing harm? Now, you know, in my view, I think that, well, when it gets to the point where you're trying to have a conversation with somebody and they keep looking down at their phone, or a text comes in, and automatically, you know, they kind of shut you right down. Or if you have a kid, a teenager, come on, folks, how many of you have teenagers that are on Call of Duty, or, you know, pick the game du jour, but Call of Duty seems like to be the big one, at least for the boys, and they're up until all hours of the morning, they can't get out of bed, they can't get to school on time, their grades suffer. So I don't think people really think about, you know, some of the consequences. And so I would imagine that, you know, it would behoove us to think about, okay, number one, acknowledge this is, you know, addictions, you know, maybe you could find, you can build a case that they're not all bad. But I would say in this case, yeah, probably not a good thing, and probably want to think about how to break that addiction. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, as we were saying before the break, this is the downside of what is a really powerful human capability. You know, this ability to use technologies to extend ourselves through them is phenomenal. It's fantastic. It's what makes us human. But when those technologies get us to do things that the technologies want or the designers want rather than things that we want to do, then it becomes problematic. And I think that sort of one of the challenges we face these days is that, you know, we evolved to deal with with technologies like hand axes literally our hands have evolved to hold things like an axe, spear, weapons, and so on. That, you know, when people made those, they did exactly what their users wanted. Now, with social media, with games, with connected games, with games that you can update, one of the things that's going on there is that the games are able to adjust themselves to keep you playing. They are able to, you can add in updates, add-ons, in-app purchases that are designed to get you to do what the game designers want you to do. And so it's more like a kind of, someone else now has a direct line into your schedule, into your brain. It's almost like if car companies wanted you to drive to Vegas, and when you set cruise control, it looked for the shortest route to Vegas and tried to take you there.
Yeah, Google Car will do that.
they'll all go to the Googleplex. So,
there you go. Exactly.
I think you mentioned also that you're 54 and I'm 50, and and I tend not to notice that, except when people say 20 years ago in 1995. And I think, that's not 20 years ago. No, wait, it actually is. But, we think about our kids as being digital natives, right? Growing up with this stuff, able to understand it in ways that we can't. But it's worth remembering, we are the first generation that grew up with personal computers. We're the ones whose brains were supposed to have been completely destroyed by hours and hours of video games and Pac-Man and Defender. And, and you might be able to make a case that the world is a slightly worse place as a result of all of that. I doubt that if Pac-Man had not been invented, we would now have world peace. But, you might be able, I suppose you could make that argument. But the point there is that, when you're dealing with kids who are immersed in these things, it is worth remembering that you probably know a lot more about what's cool about these devices than you might credit yourself, and you know a lot more about the downsides and how to manage them, and both from your own experiences in the arcades in the 80s or the 90s, but also through modeling good behavior, we can have a pretty big effect on our kids and the way that they use devices and how addicted they become. Even if they stop talking to us or they become monosyllabic, they don't stop noticing when we check our email at the dinner table or, hop onto the laptop or text people at stoplights. And so, for those of us who are parents, one of the best excuses for getting control of our digital lives is that it'll help our kids. And if you're a parent and you need a more powerful incentive than that, then you probably should seek professional help. Actually,
It's funny. We'll go out with. I've got two kids. They're one actually closing in on 18, and the oldest at 20. We'll go out just recently, around the Christmas time to a restaurant, and I might have just casually looked down at my phone at something, or maybe just checking it, very briefly. And you're absolutely right. If I or my wife do that, they are all over us. And of course, oftentimes it might be, we're having a conversation and, you know, I want to do a fact check, you know, something like that. I know that may sound like a bogus excuse, but I agree with you completely that we do have to set the example. Or let's say I'll pick it up because I want to show a picture that I something in our conversation might have prompted me to say, oh, gee, that reminds me, I wanted to show you something. I'll pick up the phone. But as soon as I do that, you know, they'll be all over us. So I think that, you know, especially, as you said, with, you know, a parent, you know, we do have to be the role models. How, you know, how do you, whether you're the parent or the kid, you know, how do you begin to break away from that? Because, you know, actually, I'm making these connections now. You know, you're bringing me back because I go back, you know, we're very close in age. You know, pre Pac-Man, pre any of the, you might even remember the, what was that first game? It was like a ping pong, right?
Yeah, pong.
It was just, yeah, yeah, there you go. And it just going back and forth. And we thought that was really cool. Can you imagine that showing, if you showed that to kids today, they'd say, what? But before that, actually, you brought back an old memory. My friends and I, we were addicted to pinball. Pinball, mm-hmm. I'm not even sure if a lot of kids know what a pinball, machine is, but yeah, you have to keep popping in those quarters because you wanted to. So I think, you know, I guess what I'm getting to here is there is that kind of a common denominator, and you know, as I think about it, so it's not just the 21st century, you know, architects of these games that are maliciously doing this. I think even with something like an arcade game, where that is the design, they want you to keep shoving the quarters in there, right? And today, I think what's really different is you can now, you don't have to be in the same arcade. In a sense, you're in a virtual arcade, and you're competing against each other, you're competing with others, and like you said, this was also interesting where, when you get a kid on one of these games, where you actually have to buy stuff so that you can get to that next level, I know a very good friend of mine. He got his credit card bill and he went through the roof. It was several hundred mm-hmm. dollars. He was actually able to, you know, he contacted the game company, which I won't name, and he was able to, you know, get a credit back on that because, you know, he was not aware that was going on. His kid, you know, was innocently, just like a 5-year-old kid. He said, "Dad, I didn't know it was costing money. It just said, you know, I was just getting these things." And so, yeah, it can be a little, you know, seemingly malicious. So, you know, so how do you begin to, because this is becoming part of what, you know, life. I mean, it's integrated into life. How do you step away from it?
Right. Well, I think first off, to stick with the example of how you explain it to kids, which is, you know, also how you solve it for yourself. One of the things that I'm finding is in giving talks to school groups is that kids themselves actually are a lot more aware of and concerned about this than we realize. You know, there is a tendency to assume that any teenager is, you know, already like a dopamine-addled click monkey who is not going to listen to warnings about Snapchat or, you know, sexting or what have you. That's definitely not true. You know, they see the negative effects on their friends, they feel it on themselves, and they want to figure out how to deal with it. But I think that with them, there are few things more powerful than pointing out the ways in which media companies and design companies try to get them hooked, right? One thing that teens hate and adults don't like either is the sense that they're being played, that they're being manipulated. Mm. And so first off, pointing this out to them is a good first step toward helping them redesign these relationships. Now, I think another thing, you know, the next important thing is to think about what kind of life you want to have and what simple things you can do to change your devices so that they support that. So, you know, a really simple example is with smartphones. Now, these are things, it's amazing to think that 7 years ago the smartphone didn't even exist.
Mm-hmm.
But now it is so ubiquitous that, you know, we can't imagine life without it. And I certainly don't want to go without mine. But, you know, when you open up the box and you take out the phone, it is set to be a machine that interrupts you constantly. You know, the default assumption is that you need to be notified about absolutely everything, and that all those notifications, all those calls, all those texts are equally important and equally urgent. Smartphones, in a sense, in that state, are like five-year-olds. In that, you know, with little kids, it doesn't matter whether they want to tell you that they found their other shoe or the house is on fire. Both of those things are equally interesting. They need to tell you right now, this instant, and it's a tragedy if you don't listen to them. What they take away from you not responding immediately is that they need to say it louder. Smartphones behave the same way. And so what we need to do is help our smartphones grow up. And the way you do that is you think about, for example, you know, when you're at a dinner party, you don't just break into a conversation, right? Or in normal life, there are some people who always have a claim on your attention and others who don't. And you can one of the things that most phones allow you to do is set different ringtones for different groups of people. So in my case, for my close family, for my immediate family and for a few close friends, I have the opening bars of Derek and the Dominoes' Layla.
All right.
You know, because no matter where I am, even though I've heard that a billion times, I am, you know, it's going to cut through the noise. I'm going to hear it. Everybody else, the whole rest of the world, gets a little piece of a solo Bach cello performed by Yo-Yo Ma.
So
that's quiet,
different.
It's unobtrusive, and when it's in my pocket, I can instantly make a choice about, you know, whether I actually want to answer it or let it go to voicemail. Because even though, you know, sort of the phone thinks that all calls are equally important, they are not. And if it's if it's a kid's school calling, or if it is, you know, a friend of a friend of a friend, those are different things. You can do the same thing with email, with texts. Just thinking about who it is who has the right to interrupt you, who has the right to take your attention at any time, and that that number for most of us is incredibly small. I think another important thing is, and I talk about this in the book, a number of pieces of software that will do things like put limits on the amount of time you give yourself to spend on social media sites or Reddit or news sites or what have you. Back in the old arcade days, you left when you ran out of quarters. Right, there was a finite resource that determined how long you could stay there, and in today's
world,
come
on, Alex, give me a quarter. I know you got a couple.
Exactly, but I can't give you more time.
I can't give you more of my time, right? Yeah.
But in today's world, where we live not in the global village that Marshall McLuhan predicted, but something more like a global arcade. There are no quarters. You can play forever. And so you need some other way some other kind of limitation, limiting factor. And then I think that another thing that people find really powerful is what they call a digital Sabbath, which is a regular practice, whether it's, just for one evening a week or one day a week, where you put all this stuff away. And you do other things. You fix the car, or take on elaborate cooking projects, or you do something else that's really engaging. You don't just stare at the walls and think, how long before I can check my mail again?
Yeah, you want to replace it with something. You want to replace it with something that's productive. I didn't coin that term, but that was something I started a long time ago. Where again, using your term, digital Sabbath, and actually. Once everybody knew, they'd even sometimes some of my siblings would poke fun. They'd say, "Oh no, don't text Scott or don't send him an email or this or the other, because you know he just kind of shuts down. I go off the grid." Listen, I want to talk more about your book. We got a break coming up, The Distraction Addiction. You've got some really interesting chapter headings: breathe, simplify, meditate, deprogram, experiment, refocus, rest. So I want to get into a little bit of that, but we'll do that right after the break. You're listening to The Business of Living, and we'll be right back right after these messages.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
All around the outermost rim of the shield, he set the mighty stream of the river Oceanus, creating Achilles' shield in Homer's The Iliad, Book 18.
Rachel Carson in The Sea Around Us said,
"All at last, return to the sea. To Oceanus, the ocean river, like the ever-flowing stream of time, the beginning and the end."
Moyer's Environmental Dialogues with Dr. Rob Moyer offers lively dialogue and revealing narrative inquiry into how individuals are overcoming obstacles and creating a greener and blue planet Earth. Tune in Thursdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific on the Voice America Variety Channel.
What sets apart VoiceAmerica.tv from the other video content providers on the internet? Choice and flexibility means that you can host your video content live or on demand on the main VoiceAmerica.tv channels through your own branded media player or your own private TV channel. We support multiple media formats, so all of your video content can be in one place. We offer a number of advertising and video packages. For more information, visit VoiceAmerica.tv. If you think you've seen online TV like this before, let us surprise you.
What if there was a radio show that could demonstrate how we can cut your taxes in half without diminishing needed government services? One that could explain how to create tens of millions of jobs at no cost to taxpayers, as well as fantastic yet easily affordable health care. Side effects include cutting crime rates nationwide, providing better education for our children, international peace and harmony, and protecting your private personal data from government intrusion. Tune in to Libertarians Working for You with Arvind Vora, weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
This is The Business of Living with Scott Ventrella. To reach the show today, call in to 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to scott@thebusinessofliving.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. We are here speaking with Alex Soojung Kim Pong, and Alex is, among other things, he is, ways to describe him, a futurist, and he's a consultant at Strategic Business Insights. It's a think tank in Silicon Valley. Alex, thank you so much for sharing some of your insights. I mean, you really got me thinking when you said, has technology become our master? You know, we're now a slave to that. And again, not your words, mine, but as I'm listening to some of your counsel, let's say, on this, I'm thinking, yeah, in a way, we have allowed technology to become our master, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. I mean, we can take control. You know, during the break, you and I were talking about the fact that, when I was in, I flew to London, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm sound asleep, and I use my smartphone as an alarm, and I get a call at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm sound asleep, and it's my mom just checking in, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, how can I control this going forward? Well, they have us put it in airplane mode. You know, when we're flying, why not just do that? Something simple. Now, of course, in my generation, we may not think of that. We, you know, we use it for, you know, various purposes. But I don't know about you, but when I got my phone, I threw it to my kid and I said, okay, here's what I need it to do. You know, make it do it. You know, I never read the instruction book, but I think my point is, you know, trying to reclaim control over this and actually, you know, technology is there to serve us, not the other way around. So in your book, The Distraction Addiction, you've got some great headings, and I'm just going to let you kind of pick out a few and, you know, share it with our audience.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things I talk about early on is the way in which our relationships with technology is actually a very physical thing. You know, you started at the beginning of the show talking about sort of the anxiety that you feel when you can't find your phone. It's like losing your wallet. Well,
It's worse now, I think, for a lot of people because there's so much on the phone.
Yeah.
We'd rather lose our wallet, I think, now than our phone, especially when we get, you know, when the iWallet becomes more popular. Yeah.
You know, but there's something called email apnea, which is let me give a different example. Have you ever had the feeling that your phone was ringing or vibrating, but it actually wasn't in that pocket?
Absolutely. Yes.
Right. Okay. So that's something called phantom cell phone syndrome. And interestingly, it's something that people like emergency workers or doctors have more severely than the rest of us. Because, you know, if you're a resident and you miss a phone call, then that's a really, really bad thing.
So
much worse than, you know, just like if you're a technology consultant like me. But, you know, it's a really nice example of how our bodies become primed develop a kind of awareness of these devices and learn to kind of unconsciously pay attention to them. And so, you know, I think that sort of doing something as simple as no longer carrying your phone in your pants pocket, but, you know, making a habit of keeping it in the, you know, in your bag or in a jacket pocket turns out to be a simple but very effective way of beginning to kind of decouple sort of your body from the phone and helping you basically regain control over it. But there are all kinds of ways that, you know, our relationships with our technologies are not just things that happen between the screen and our eyes or, you know, the keypad and our fingers, but involve a lot more of ourselves than we normally notice. So that's really what Breathe is about. It's about the embodied quality of our relationships with these technologies.
And I like the connection because I think of it as, so it's almost like an umbilical cord or being tethered to it. And actually just last night traveling back from Los Angeles, I thought for sure, oh gosh, that's a call coming in. And I reached for my top pocket where the sensation was, and the phone wasn't there. So that's why I chuckled when you said that. I thought, that is so weird. It had to be the phone, but it wasn't. I think the idea of physically, you know, getting some space between, for instance, unless I need, like this morning, because I got in at 4 a.m., unless I need to, you know, I want a fail-safe way of making sure I get up in the morning, you know, then I will, because the smartphone is very reliable in terms of, you know, as an alarm. But unless I need it for a specific reason, I do not bring it up. I leave it as far away from me, you know, down two levels in the house, so that I don't have that. Because when I do use it as an alarm and it's on my nightstand, usually the first thing I'll do is I'll take it out of airplane mode and I start checking email and I'm laying in bed. I don't want to do that. So I think the physical separation is good.
Yeah, I am amazed. And I learned this from some engineers at a technology company here who, you know, here in Silicon Valley. And you would think that, you know, these are the people who would be most connected to their devices, but they're the ones who, because they spend all day with them, are also most susceptible to this kind of overuse. And so, you know, they try to sort of put as much distance as they can between themselves and their smartphones without it, you know, sort of, but not so far that, or, you know, they can't hear it. They can't hear Layla playing when their spouse calls.
Yeah, right. So. Okay, got it. Now, another chapter here. I'm just looking at, you have Simplify.
Simplify. Right. No, you know, this is about a category of software called Zenware. And one of the things that is that turns out to be a big time sink with especially of computers and laptops is the complexity of software. Right? Microsoft Word, for example, has, you know, something like 150 different fonts now. And you can spend immense amounts of time with of these kinds of big programs doing stuff that feels like work, changing margins, adjusting, you know, sort of spending hours in Photoshop making tiny adjustments to contrast or other things, rather than that feels productive, but it really isn't. There are categories of software called Zenware that strip down of programs to the very minimum kind of feature set that you need in order to get things done. You know, what's fascinating about them, two things. And you know, number one is how many, for example, serious writers move away from things like Microsoft Word in favor of a tool called WriteRoom, which makes your computer look like sort of an old cathode ray terminal from 1980, down to the green, the green letters and the blinking cursor. But for them, having that incredibly simple experience turns out to be really focusing. The other thing that is really notable about Zenware is that it's a really good lesson in how less can be more, in how sometimes the most useful tools are not ones that try to do 1,000 different things, but try to do the one critical thing. And we are so accustomed to thinking about more powerful, more feature-rich software being better that we tend to forget that tools, whether they are software, whether they are hardware, that allow us to do exactly the thing that we need done are actually the most powerful ones because they empower us. That's something that is really worth relearning.
I'm really intrigued by Meditate. So I'm thinking, Alex, where and how does this fit in?
So, well, it's first off that learning to meditate, even if you do it terribly, and I have to confess I do. Awful lot of time on the mat, and I feel like, you know, it's always a struggle. But as a reminder how useful it can be to allow your mind to simply be unattached to other stuff, whether it's your phone or your tablet or the world at large. Learning how to do that turns out to have all kinds of health and medical benefits. But in our case, it's also really useful because it is a fabulous contrast to the kind of mental state that you get into when you're multitasking. And when you learn, when you practice meditation, one of the things that happens is that the kind of sense of urgency that you feel about, when you've got 7 different programs and tabs open, that becomes less appealing. So, and I learned this from a group of Buddhist monks and nuns who I talk about in the book, who are social media entrepreneurs, but also are Buddhist monks. And, they talk about how it's possible to practice a very kind of meditative or a very Zen technology use. And that, for them, doing stuff like managing a YouTube channel or a blog is not at all distracting. And I think that as a group that shows us that it's possible to make mindful choices about our technologies, they are sort of really exemplary. So now it's also the case, you know, just that this isn't just like an Eastern Buddhist sort of thing, that there is an incredibly long, rich contemplative history in Christianity as well, you know, in Islam. There's basically sort of every religion has a contemplative tradition of one sort or another from which we can draw. So, you know, it's just a matter of sort of choosing which one sort of works best for you or that you're sort of most comfortable with. But, you know, in a world that is constantly trying to sort of capture and commoditize and resell your attention, learning how to retake control of it in an incredibly simple way is, in incredibly simple circumstances, is a fabulously valuable mental discipline.
You know, I'm so glad to hear you say that because, again, when I saw it, I thought, wow, well now, does he really mean meditate? And yes, you really mean
meditate. Really do.
And I like that because it brings us almost to the opposite end. It brings us to this place. And I, by the way, I don't do I have different forms more akin to the, you know, kind of the Christian, let's say, ethic. But same thing where I can just go into a quiet place, quiet state of mind, calm my mind, and also I think just shutting off stuff. And I don't mean just I'm talking about TV, radio. How many times you see people get in the car or at home, the first thing they do is flip on the TV or the radio. Right. I think, you know, just to be able to be kind of quiet in your, you know, in your own mind and you know, almost literally you just kind of shut down and get a sense of calm and away from everything. Alex, you have been just tremendously helpful. Actually, I've learned so much. You know, old guy like me, and I'm sure a lot of the younger folks, you know, they're on top of all this stuff. You know, the right room, I'd never heard of that. Got to check into that. And Zenware and all that stuff. You've been a huge help to, I think, to not only me, but I think to a lot of our listeners. We've been speaking with Alex Soojung Kim Pong. He is the author. You know, check it out. It's The Distraction Addiction. And he's got his next book already on the, well, it's in the, you know, early stages, but, you know, keep a lookout for REST, How Working Less Gets More Done. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. It's a real pleasure, Scott.
And thank you all for joining us on The Business of Living. Hey, be sure to tune in next week. We'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Living. Please join Scott Ventrella for another edition of the show next Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. We'll see you here next Saturday.